I really enjoyed your talk. It was great.
Is this part of the podcast? Are we recording?
Well, I think, I don't know if we're recording. Are we recording?
We're always recording.
No, we've been recording the whole time.
Or for 10 seconds.
We're really in the podcast now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. This is Justin. Hi, Justin Searles. We're joined by Justin Searles.
Hello.
You mean Sam Pippen.
It's very strange to kind of have concluded this journey that I've been on for 6.5 years speaking at Ruby conferences to, you know, be introduced as a keynote speaker at RailsConf and then like not have to have that name explained. Well, here's his background and here's what, you know, so it was really, really, I think just, an important special moment for me today to get to share this particular story with such a big audience of other developers, because, you know, if I've had one message, whether it's through talking about feelings or talking about testing, you know, over the years, it's really just that I think that it's a real shame that programmers tend to act like they know things that they don't. And it makes this whole industry such a scary place to be if you're really, you know, self-conscious and aware of the fact that you don't know what you're doing. For other people to kind of, you know, make out like they do. So this talk was kind of my love letter to just sort of the anxieties that I think a lot of us live with and carry.
Yeah. I'm guilty of the pretending I know things I don't. Like, somebody will ask a question, and particularly in asynchronous communication, like somebody asks a question in Slack and I just happen to be good enough to piece together the words to put into Google. And then I read the answer and I write the answer out. But I don't say, like, I didn't know this answer. Here's what I Googled to find it. Because that also seems kind of like, let me Google this for you kind of thing. So I just say, like, I know this answer. And sometimes people get the impression that I know a lot of things. It's like, no, maybe I'm a little bit better at Googling. Like, or I'm experienced enough to know what to Google and what not to Google.
I mean, that is, like, an underrated skill, though. Because you do oftentimes, to find the right answer, you have to put, you know, knowing the words put into the search bar. It's not always obvious.
I like sometimes I have those problems, and like I'll be working with somebody and they're like, well, did you try putting the exact error message into Google that you were getting? It's like, no, I didn't.
Yeah, and I think that there is a certain, you know, you want to be helpful and provide a concrete, clear answer that is comprehensible and straightforward. And to any extent that you open up the sausage factory of all your thought processes or how you got to that conclusion or your own doubts, you run the risk of confusing people or coming across as mealy-mouthed or just wasting their time. And so there's, especially like, you know, like imagine you're in a pull request review or something. If you go on at length and length, I can understand the value of brevity and terseness, but I think our industry leans so hard in that direction that very often we run the risk of coming across as cold and callous, know-it-all assholes. Right. And so guarding against that is something that I think we can all probably stand to practice.
I do like when I submit a pull request, particularly when it's like, if I'm pretty certain in the approach I took, but if I have any sort of uncertainty in the approach I took, I like list what my uncertainty about that is and like the three other things I considered and why I thought like either it was a toss up and this was just the easiest for me to do, or like I thought this was slightly better, but maybe you disagree. Let me know if you do, that kind of thing.
And you put that in the commit message.
Yeah. I put it all right in the pull request or the commit message.
Yeah.
And that tends to like lead to some pretty good discussion. Yeah. And sometimes it's actually just like, yeah, okay, that seems reasonable. Whereas if I just like confidently submit the thing, it's like, well, did you try this? Did you try that? And like, yeah, it's a bit more of an adversarial conversation from the start than like if I just let people know that, no, I'm not 100% sure about what I've done here.
Well, and it is really nice too sometimes. Like, I remember it was a month ago, I was working on something around joins in Diesel. I don't remember what it was, but I was looking at some code and I'm just like, this is weird and dumb. Why is it this way? It could be this other way and that would be so much simpler. And so I blamed it, and the commit message was, so I considered doing it this other way and I tried it for a little bit, but that ended up not working out because of X, Y, and Z. And I'm like, oh, cool, that just saved me an hour.
And as GitHub has gotten to its search functionality, you know, is pretty bare bones when we probably all started using it. As the search has gotten better, you're not feeding Google, you're feeding GitHub in the ability for people who might have a question about a particular repository or design decision. Those in progress thoughts that you share in your commit messages and in your pull requests can kind of feed that, so to prevent people from opening up, you know, redundant issues or unnecessary things. because those will bubble up. But there's also times, you know, to give the counterpoint to all this is like, there are times where I just know something. Like I jokingly say like no one knows how to program, but like, you know, you can develop true expertise in this field, and coming across well and being helpful to people can become more and more challenging as you lose sight of the beginner's mindset. You know, one area where I have a almost exclusive level of expertise is test doubles. You know, like I've written 4 or 5 mocking libraries in different languages. You know, our company's named it almost half jokingly because it's sort of this evergreen topic. And there's only really half a dozen people that I know that I can really have like a peer like discussion about the merits with, because there's just so many strange little details and historical notes and jargon and stuff. And so that's where I personally really run the risk of turning people off, because it's difficult for me to break up those concepts in a way that a neophyte would be able to relate to.
Yeah. My area of expertise is don't use bubble sort.
The test double thing just reminded me, like, you did a video screencast series maybe a while ago about like mockist versus classical. Is that what it is? Or?
Yeah, well, there's not good terminology. So just to break it down, you know, you could say classical test-driven development is what the extreme programming fellows did in the quote-unquote 3Cs project at Chrysler in the late 90s, early 2000s, and sort of laid the groundwork for a lot of classical TDD. You know, there's people like Ron Jeffries, Ward Cunningham, Kent Beck was in the room, Chet Hendricks. They were all practicing those skills. And if you've ever done the bowling game Kata or learned TDD, you probably learned that kind of test-driven development. But around the same time, the London Extreme Programming Group was coming along, and they had this outside-in, you know, what Martin Fowler would call a mockist style of test-driven development, which I really hate that word. The word mock is just really negative framing, and it has specific meanings and yada yada. So nowadays, I just call what I do outside-in or discovery testing.
Right. Yeah. When those came out, I was like, I have a pretty firm understanding of this. And I watched that and I was like, oh, he has a much more firm understanding of this.
Well, it is a 4.5 hour long screencast. So.
And I've always, because I think a lot of people have gone through phases of not using mocks, mocking literally everything all of the time, kind of going through the two extremes.
Mm.
On the using a lot of mocks extreme, I do find that it does a great job of helping me explicitly draw out my interfaces a lot earlier than I would otherwise.
Mm.
And as I'm right now in a little bit of like fewer mocks, but still some mocks kind of phase. And I have been struggling to kind of find how to maintain that feedback on the interface design as early as it came, when I was testing every object in complete isolation. Do you have any thoughts on how to mock less but still get that feedback?
Well, I'm going to go ahead and assume that everyone other than Sean who's listening to this did watch the talk first. So I'm going to work from that assumption just for the purpose of this answer. So it might not make a ton of sense to you. But in the way that I've come to organize my code, anything whose job it is, so basically follow an edict that says do or delegate, never both. And any unit of code can either do the job that it says on the tin or pass it off to other units that'll be subordinate to it to do that work for it. I don't really believe in balance as a human. I mean, if anyone who follows my personal life on Twitter or how I blog, I am all about chasing the
eating habits.
Yeah, eating habits, my walking desk, you know, how I run every day. I'm a weird guy. And so that divide, to say really clearly and just draw a line in the sand, you are either a delegator who just carves work up, and if you have any logic, it's like an if condition or maybe a loop. Or you're a doer. You actually do the work, and I try to make you a pure function. That draws a line in the sand that says those delegators, of course, 100% of the stuff in their unit test should be mocked out, because the purpose of the unit test is to break up the work.
Right.
And for those doers, those pure functions, a testable does not belong there, because it should just be able to pass in values and get values out the other end.
Sure.
Same goes for integration tests. You know, the purpose of an integration test is wholly different. When everything's glued together, does the thing work? And any fakeness that you introduce there just weakens the veracity of the test, our trust that it's actually doing its job. And so test doubles don't belong there either. And so I can go off and describe 10 different types of tests to you.
Sure.
And only one would test doubles actually be appropriate.
Right,
so
right.
That's the sort of silly thing about this, is that unless you have a very, very, I think, discrete mindset around types of tests, it can be just confusing. And that's why, you know, I didn't want to have a whole discussion about testables. I probably shouldn't have brought it up. But like, when you look at like a Rails application, the test suites in there are likely to have like, I'm a model test. I'm talking to the database. I just randomly poked a hole in this other object over here with the test double because I don't know, it was causing pain and now I don't. And that's 99.9% of how actual like mock objects are used in practice. They don't give the design feedback. They just make the test worse. And so I feel like I spend most of my time telling people, no, don't do that. Which is less fun than it sounds.
Right. I definitely like, I flip back and forth between like, I'm using a lot of, like Sean, like I'm using a lot of test doubles here, or I am not. And the reason why I struggle with flipping back and forth is what you just captured is like, I have things that are both doing and delegating, right? Mm-hmm. And so if I use a double there, I feel like, oh, well, I'm cheating because that's like, I didn't calculate that value off a real object. I just like mocked it, and that's not like, that's not good. But then it helps me in the design feedback of that delegating part because I don't actually care about the actual value.
I really would challenge you to say that like you're that's got to be a mixed level of abstraction.
Yes.
If you're carving out some of the work for some things, but oh, this is just a little bit of math, I will also do this little bit of math.
Yep.
That's what I think the people who do outside in test driven development often talk about it as a design feedback mechanism. It's like, as soon as that test hurts to write, that means that like you've got mixed levels of abstraction. Right. You need to just do one or the other thing.
Right. The other thing, I was talking to somebody about your talk already, and I was like, I really liked the way that you broke up the feature that we were kind of walking through, right? And like basically wrapped everything was one of the things, mm-hmm. one of the points of the talk. And I was like, I really like doing that, but I feel like when I do that, I'm straying from what people expect to find like in a controller, right? They expect me to call like user.find or user.all and have that be an active record user object. And then I balance, like, to me, it's okay. Like, cause I'm like, I understand what's happening here. But then I wonder like, well, am I doing my clients a disservice by like introducing this other thing that's different from what they're going to see in most Rails apps?
You asked the question, like, what do you expect to find when you open a Rails controller? The answer is you expect to find a rat's nest. So yes. I don't know that that's like necessarily the bar we want to hold ourselves to.
That was my entire talk as well. So yeah, I agree with you.
But at the same time, again, I want to bring the counterpoint, right? Like for a straightforward CRUD application that doesn't have a lot of very fancy logic, just painting by numbers and putting your stuff in the right Rails bucket can get you from 0 to 60 very quickly.
Yep.
So you just as the team have to make the determination whether or not you're going the vanilla Rails route or if you're going to start breaking out stuff. And if you break out stuff, like what's that watermark, the threshold where you decide, okay, we're going to break out and do all of this in custom POROs, plain old objects that mm-hmm. are divorced from Rails. And it's got to be a conscientious decision.
I do feel like the network can kind of mess up the separations, both in when you want to mock things out and also in what is doing or delegating. Because when you're making a network call, that is sort of by definition delegating at least some amount of work to whatever you're calling out to. And mm-hmm. oftentimes, depending on the API, you'll want to mock out that API that you're integrating with in your integration tests even, because it's just not an API that you can act. For example, Stripe is an API that you more or less just can't directly test against, at least in your automated tests. Whereas like, if you're integrating with S3, that's one where I usually like to, in most of my tests, hit the actual API and then just use VCR to speed it up, but have the cassettes, you know, checked into gitignore and expire semi-frequently, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It's one of those interesting ones to me where it's a thing that you often want to mock out, and it kind of causes you to break a lot of the rules that you'd otherwise have about when to mock or stub something.
I'm really glad that you raised that, because it's one of the things I had to cut from the talk, which is I mentioned wrappers at the end as wrapping third-party open source code, but that was already the longest section of the talk. And what I really wanted to add to it was to say that third-party libraries, even if we're counting standard lib, the vast majority of our asynchronous stuff and our IO is going to be invoked via that stuff, as opposed to some, not like I'm going to like socket.new inside my application typically. Right. And so those wrappers actually also give us a way to demarcate ourselves from side effects where, you know, in fact, another observation of these trees that I keep drawing is that they sort of map, you can visualize one, close your eyes, imagine a tree of nodes in a system. The stuff on the left is usually loading stuff, getting information from different systems and databases. The stuff in the middle is like mostly transformations and beating that data into submission. And the stuff in the right is where all the side effects and results go.
Right.
You know, you sending signals to other systems. And those little wrapper objects in my unit tests, you know, I just fake out the wrapper because I fake out all of the subordinate stuff.
Right.
And then I have like a nice little crystallized place to, you know, if I'm just calling Stripe and I trust that Stripe works, maybe I have no tests. But if the Stripe API or the Facebook API starts breaking in a certain particular way, and I want to guard against that, then maybe I start a brand new test suite of just against that.
Right.
So I have like a green and red light tells me whether or not my assumptions about that third-party API are currently safe. And if I do that and I follow these rules carefully, then that's what gives me the freedom in my totally separate integration test to perhaps, you know, use a web mock or VCR kind of approach to here's a fixture of a response from Stripe so that I don't have to go and call the universe so that I can make sure that the overall app works even when I'm on an airplane. That kind
of thing. Right. Testing on airplanes is a thing that's very important to a very small group of people.
I was
going to
say, yeah. That is a sign of privilege that, like, you know, the vast majority of my programming happens on airplanes.
Yeah.
So it is very important that you be able to run your tests without a internet connection.
How many people have filled out your the Searles-Briggs
test? Oh, yeah. So the Searles-Briggs
type
indicator of programmer personalities is a raging success. So I think we're at like 350 responses to the online edition. I've handed out about 100 paper form ones. We actually already at in our Slack at Testdouble, we already have people like crunching numbers and looking at the distributions of different types of programmers. And I was actually worried that like 100% of people would just get salt because I was so biased in writing the questions. But actually, I have got some very unpopular opinions, it turns out. And some of the questions have very normal distributions. I'm trying to think of the "we are not doomed" question was interesting.
I answered three on that one, which is totally
cop-out. Yeah, we got some middle of the road ones. A lot more people were optimistic though than pessimistic, which surprised me, but not when I consider the fact that RailsConf attendees, like a ton of first timers are here, so a bunch of, you know, young, naive.
See, the "we are not doomed" I agreed with. It was the software is generally getting better. I'm just like,
yeah, I was more like, software is probably not generally getting better, but we're probably all, like, we're doomed, but maybe not because of software.
Sure, yeah.
I don't know, I feel like three was really...
Three, I was like, I'm going to cop out on this one and go three. I was an F-A-L-T, a fault, fault.
I was a Fanta.
I felt so badly because somebody tweeted out that they got fail. F-A-L-E, and it never even occurred to me. I thought I'd spelled them all out, and I felt really badly. So I reached out to the person and said, you know, all programmers are beautiful.
You need to rethink your positions on these items so you can change one of these letters.
No. It's all good, you know, and you could look at somebody like a fine would probably be very well suited for startup life where you're pivoting all the time and you need to be able to experiment. Whereas, you know, this actually gives me a model for understanding why it is I'm so bad at startup work or building an MVP. Like, I'm much better suited for people who have really big, complex, gnarly legacy rescues because I love that surgical approach to solving problems.
Hmm. So I'm curious how much of developing this thing was something that, like, you wanted to use as a vehicle for the talk versus something that you think actually could be useful, or is it both?
Developing a talk, especially when you spend a couple hundred hours on it like I do, it's a symbiotic thing after a while. So in this particular case, I started off knowing everything I wanted to say. I've got a gigantic mind map that's like, you know, it would probably take me 50 feet by 30 feet on a plot printer to print out like the entire outline for the talk. And I just needed a way, I needed a rhetorical hook to tie it all together somehow. And so it was in thinking of the Myers-Briggs test as sort of like a personality inventory was a way to try to tell a story of two threads. One, I did want to share the way that I program with everyone. As this is my particular style. Here you go, make up your own. And so I wanted a through line that would force me to actually show you bit by bit how, and you can see over the course of the talk how my process gets more and more complex and how like it's actually second order aspects of that tree shape that enable interesting other observations, like the fact that you can easily blow away and replace entire components, which you couldn't do if you were in like a normal kind of object graph. So I did want to tell that story, but I also really clearly wanted to tell people, this is something that you own. You don't get to just listen to this and then follow yet another thought leader's prescribed way of doing stuff. And so instead, the audience participation angle of having this test and having this personality inventory for you to think about, my hope is that most people don't get salt. And then they say, well, how will I differ from Justin then in how I design my own way? And maybe they'll share that.
Awesome. I agree. It was good.
I also just think, like, as I was talking to people who were like new to the conference and stuff, they were like, what are you looking forward to? And I was like, oh, Justin's keynote's going to be great. So I think that you've done a really good job at like it's obvious that you care and care a great deal in like not wasting anybody's time and like making sure you put your best foot forward. And like, as I was developing my own talks, and I've only done a couple now, but like, that's the number one thing I try and care about is like, am I wasting anybody's time?
Yep.
Like, and I'm so afraid, like even the talk I gave, I was like, I'm so afraid that this is so obvious. And like, just as I was walking over here to record this podcast, somebody was like, hey, I really liked your talk. I was like, great. Thank you very much. And then they were like, it sounded so obvious, but sometimes the really obvious thing just needs to be said. And it's hard to know, like, am I being just obvious here?
There is a massive difference. And I think most developers will resonate with this idea. There's a massive difference between obvious and obvious in hindsight. Obvious in hindsight is stuff that's like a simple solution to a problem that we all share and are struggling to articulate. And I trust it was that kind of obvious, where after the fact, sure, it sounds like pretty straightforward advice.
Right.
But for some reason, we keep failing at it. And you know what? Even if it is obvious, if teams around the world keep failing at the thing, then maybe it needs to be said anyway.
Right. That's kind of the opinion. I was like, this seems like it is hindsight, because like when you're on the other side of it, you're like, of course that makes sense. But yeah.
Just from a speaker and attendee point of view, I don't know how intentional this was, but I'm assuming it was very intentional. You ended like exactly on time, and I respect how hard that is to do.
Oh my goodness, this is funny. So last week I gave this talk, the only other time I'll probably give it, a Deconstruct Conf in Seattle, Washington, by a young man named Gary Bernhardt. And he invited all these speakers, and so no pressure, because Gary is only one of the most practiced speakers on whatever you would call this circuit. And I had a 25-minute slot, and I told him I was going to go a few minutes over, and I landed around 29 minutes. And I felt badly for that, but in fairness to me, which is the only kind of fairness I care about, in fairness to me, the screen was flickering, and I lost like 2 minutes of runtime, and so his AV problems are his fault. However, what's so interesting, and this confirms my business partner Todd's theory that I'm just full of hot air, and will fill whatever container I am given. I had 45 minutes this time for this talk, and I only added like 5 slides. And somehow, I do 597 slides in 29 minutes last week, and I had the exact same slides for the most part, managed to take me exactly 45 minutes today. So it's really difficult for me to slow down without just rambling and getting into stupid storytelling time and just derail things. But I really did my best today in the interest of both not wasting people's time, of course, and try to bring some energy to the table. These are big topics that take a lot of time to process. And by speaking a little slower than I normally do, I hope that it may be sunk in a little bit more with folks.
Yeah.
Sweet. So, so what's new?
Nothing.
Nothing is new. Literally, our entire field is just rediscovering.
Yeah, actually,
yeah, there's nothing new under the sun.
That is actually a conversation I actually had with somebody, I think here. Basically, they had only ever worked for one company, and they were looking for another job. And because one of the, I was like, oh, interesting. Or like, one of the things I want to know is like, how much of the problems that I'm solving are my company's problems versus how much are just common problems? And I was like, oh, they're all common problems. I was like, your company has one or two probably that are kind of unique to you, and each of them has like a separate little flavor. But like, as I do more and more development, it's like we're all just kind of like, it was your talk, right? Where you were like, we're all just trying to put spreadsheets on the internet.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's it.
I also like being quoted during my own interview. We all do struggle with a lot of the same types of problems. You know, Derek, I know you've been consulting for a long time like me, and we as consultants really, I think, get to see a lot of different teams, and we start to see a lot of the patterns across projects. Mm-hmm. And so we're able to be somewhat authoritative in our, you know, no, you're not a special snowflake. Everyone runs into this when they use Factory Girl kind of issues. Oh, right. This podcast is sponsored by the Factory Girl gem. However, when you are feeling like there's nothing new to say, or that you've seen every problem before. You could do what I do and become a manager. and now I try to, like, you know, help people through their own journey to find, you know, like, to succeed through them more. And I'm finding that to be more fulfilling now that I'm actually putting in the time to actively mentor and put in effort advocating on behalf of our developers, like Josh Greenwood and Sam Jones, who are starting to speak more, Ali Ibrahim, who's like organizing and Be More on Rails in the Baltimore community. And I find that really fulfilling. And I don't know how long I'll be doing it, but I suspect that because this industry, especially when you're in the enterprise CRUD web app industry, which, you know, is only like 70% of the IT trillion dollar bucket out there, I'm curious about taking what I've learned here and applying it to very, very different disciplines inside of software and technology. It'll probably be 5 to 10 years before I really get a chance, but that's where my head is at, is thinking, you know, like, what's this look like when I apply it to a, you know, a biotech battery company or some other thing? I can't even, I want to say deep learning, I don't know.
Neural networks.
I know so little about the world outside of the spreadsheet
creating
on
web apps.
The internet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I do miss, from like a Rails maintainer point of view, being a consultant, even though some people on the team think that consultants are the scum of the earth, it does give you a very, very broad perspective of the problems that a lot of people are facing. To a certain extent, you only get that surface level view. You know, working at Shopify now, there's the flip side of just getting a really deep understanding of some of the bigger problems that are faced just by the larger, much more legacy app. But I do definitely miss just getting to see a lot of apps and a lot of different types of problems, because that does give you, for writing open source libraries, such a, you understand what a lot more people are looking for that way.
Yeah, I like to think of consulting as I'm just farming for ideas of patterns and things that I can share with other people. Like, it's almost like I view it as an opportunity to, when I identify a pattern, a problem that a lot of people are walking into, I don't generally build open source necessarily, or I don't jump to that right away unless I have an immediate problem to solve. But instead, I think that it's an opportunity to make software more human, to say, like, hey, look, you're struggling with this. Guess what? Everyone else is too. You know, it's not you're not special. It's this is a common thing everyone runs into. Let's all talk about it, put it on the table, give it a name, explain different ways to solve it. And that's one reason why, even though we're in year 12, I think, of RailsConf, and Rails is a pretty much, you know, well-established known quantity, there's some evergreen problems in software. I'm attracted to them. That's why I've always focused on testing and legacy rescue, because those two never are going to be solved, per se. But mining different teams for the problems of the moment that they're struggling with, I think, is a good opportunity to bring us together across our little tiny pockets and ecosystems.
Yeah. When I first started at ThoughtBot, I had like some insecurities around like these people are so much better at Rails and probably development in general than I am. And like I spent, I think it maybe been a few weeks, and I've been working on this, you know, I got this new feature to work on, and I like tried it one way, it didn't work. Tried it another way, I didn't like the way it came out. Tried it a third way, still didn't work. So I'd spent like a day and a half and had nothing to show for it. And like I was talking to Matt Monjo Goose, I was like complaining to him. I was like, look, I've just like wasted the last 2 days of work. And his response was, well, what'd you do? And I told him, like, I tried this, I tried that. And he was like, well, you just found three ways that don't work. Like, that's the job. Sometimes you just find three ways that don't work. And I was like, oh, that kind of is the job, of course. Like, sometimes you don't know the right answer and it takes time to figure it out. And you have to recognize that, like, finding out that those three ways don't work wasn't wasted time. That was valuable.
Yeah.
As long as you learn from that.
I don't know. It does always just feel a lot worse, though, when you have, you know, there are certain types of ideas or solutions that you come up with, and the only real way to know if it's going to work is just to go through all the trouble of implementing it, and then you're 2 days later and nope, this was a bad idea. It does just really feel bad.
Yeah, but overcoming that, I think, is to the point of, like, going back to Justin's point of, like, yeah, everybody does have this problem, but it, bringing the more human side to that is, like,
sure.
Yeah, but, like, that's going to happen, and that's normal, and that's,
yeah.
You know.
So, one of the things that I'm interested in is what does Rails look like over the next 3 or 4 years? And when I say Rails, I really just mean the Ruby community more generally, because I don't spend all of my time here. I spend a lot of time in just JavaScript land or just generally, I go to Hacker News and I know, Ruby isn't, lighting up the charts anymore and hasn't been for 4 or 5 years. I just had a conversation with Yehuda at lunch where, I was asking about the state of the Ember world, and he had to use the word still a lot, or it's going like as if like, I didn't ask it in a negative framing or apply any sort of judgment to it. But there is I tried to kind of get at this in the talk as being, part of what's problematic in software, us not understanding it, is that there's a newsworthiness aspect to software tools. We're always chasing the newest one. We have this novelty bias to think newer frameworks and ways of doing things are inherently better. And so if your thing, whether that's Ember or Rails or Ruby, isn't in the news, well, then it's old stuff. Yeah. And it must not be as good as new stuff. And we know that's not true, and people listening to your podcast know that's not true, and yet we have not yet replaced that orange website with something that is, a font of the more eternal knowledges. Because we know at the end of the day, like, it's actually after your thing stops being in the news that you can finally shut up and be productive.
Right.
And build valuable stuff.
I think people, we were talking about this earlier today, I think people really underestimate the value of an established ecosystem.
Mm.
The one thing from DHH's keynote that really did resonate a lot was it doesn't really matter if you're picking the best tool for the job, as long as you're picking a tool for the job and you get something done. You're going to be able to get a lot more done with the more established tool just because there's gems for everything you need. Your problem's already solved, but then that's not exciting.
Yeah, and it's, one of the things that has bothered me about NPM is the extent to which, and it's exciting to see particular modules get downloaded 18 gajillion times every month, but download count doesn't tell the real story. I think the number of modules is a very interesting thing. So, NPM has a massive number of modules, and, I've written 100, so, at least 100 are crap. But but that is really interesting when you think about the size of dependencies over the years continues to go down. The number of dependencies per project keeps going up. And so the amount of wheels that we reinvent is theoretically lower, but now the dependencies are also small that it's like we're actually making wheels out of other wheels where you have to kind of curate your own collection of dozens and dozens of different dependencies, and that's what a project means. And so, like I said earlier, I'm a person of extremes and I like taking things really far. But when I see a lot of Node.js projects, which is, a very anti-framework kind of bent as a community, a lot of them are almost radically modular and extreme. Whereas not only does Ruby shouldn't try to sell itself as we're a mature ecosystem, because people think mature means old and crappy.
Right.
Or that there's a gem for everything, because you will lose that battle, right? There's a reason why Asset Pipeline was really cool in 2011.
Right.
But now no one would want to build their JavaScript transpilation in Ruby because there's so much stuff in NPM. So you're going to lose that too. But what you might be able to win is these are well thought out, batteries included, toolkits that solve all sorts of common problems. And if you pull it down, you're going to get taken care of because they've thought about all the angles of the problem when you pull in a dependency like Faye, or even Factory Girl is a lot bigger and more robust than most kind of, fake testing tools for Node.js. And so slicing it at the right size to be useful so as not to be overwhelming, I think, is a true benefit of the Ruby ecosystem.
Yeah.
When I did do a little bit of Node work, the first Node app I wrote, and it was like, okay, well, we need something, gives us some routing or whatever. And it was like, oh, Express. I was like, all right.
Mm-hmm.
So we got Express. And then I was like, oh, okay, well, I need it. I don't know, cross-site request forgery protection. And it was like, oh, well, you got to get this thing. I was like, all right. Or you got to pick between these things. All right, well, which one of these do I need? And it does give you decision fatigue. You're like, oh, I have to make every one of these decisions? And it's so different. And I know that some people really love that because they can pick and choose, or they can choose not to ignore an total part of, they're an API. They don't need cross-site request forgery or whatever.
Yeah, I kind of hate the particularly on security, that is because you need to know that you need to look for a thing that protects you from CSRF, which a lot of developers won't.
Right. But it's just a different perspective on it, and I think that is a fair way to compare those two communities in particular, and it's you may value one over the other, and there's going to be plenty of people who value each one, and it's not like saying, well, we're mature. and therefore you are immature, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that's one reason that I think that there are just an infinite number of interesting spectrums, as opposed to treating it like dichotomies, like mature or not mature, but right. like spectrums of, I use the phrase batteries included, mm-hmm. like what size of battery comes with the thing, right? Like, whereas like with Node, maybe it's like you get one of those little watch batteries that comes with that little tiny itty bitty CSRF module that you're describing. And maybe with Ruby, it's the standard two AAs, and that's something that a lot of us are comfortable with. And then maybe you go to like, you know, Java, Scala, and it's like, you know, four D cells to set up your, you know, Jersey Spring JSON API. And every company and every team and every developer is going to have a different disposition for what they're comfortable with. But we don't have a great language for that. We're not talking about that very often as a way to organize ourselves as programmers. And so I think that there's a lot of opportunity there. You know, DHH is right. Most people just land where they land because somebody told them, hey, go use this, and it worked well enough, so they used it. And then they developed this tribalistic sports yeah. team, hoorah-rah, mm-hmm. bias towards that particular technology stack.
Because they don't want to be wrong. They don't right. want to have taken the wrong bet, right? Or yeah. placed the wrong bet.
Well, and there's valid reason to have that tribalism, though, right? I mean, not that it's a good thing, but it is definitely motivated by if the more you're not wrong, the more secure your job is, the more developers using the same stack as you and the more jobs there are for that stack, the better off you
are. I'm not saying it's not rational. I'm right. saying that if you give in and say programming is about faith
right.
and picking out the best thing is mostly just following the herd, it can be a cop-out because it's a conversation ender. Well, I use Rails because it was handed unto me in 2005 when I was, you know, first learning modern web application development. And instead, what I'd really like to see is more and more discussions about maybe we're not going to get to the, you know, DHH's whipping boy in that talk was like the double blind study that actually proves without a doubt, right. like in a clean room environment, that this framework is better than that framework. It's true we're never going to get there, but I think we're still really immature at how we compare different mm-hmm. technology approaches, because it's not just about the technology, it's about how humans interact with it, and it's what like the flow of development feels like. And the cadence of delivery and operations
right.
and all that
and
other
stuff. What you can do study is on teams doing projects of similar size, and you can try and determine defect rates and rate of shipping and that sort of thing. Like there are ways that you can do studies.
Right, and like the point that like, oh, we've been doing this for 30 years and we haven't found a solution yet, therefore a solution must not be findable. Is kind of like 30, that's actually not a long time for an industry to exist.
Well, and like, you know, programming languages have not changed at all in 30 years.
All roads lead to JavaScript. They're all yep. kind of converging in a strange way. And I think you're both right, but I think that DHH's point is we don't have time to generate the hard data, even
right.
if there is
yes.
a way to measure everything. You know, it's not like you're going to fund that study.
Right. And you're not going to wait to, like, let me resolve this before I build my web app that I need, right?
So. Right. And so that's why I think that qualitative descriptions, which is what I specialize in, is touchy-feely interpretations of software. Why I think they can be useful is because somebody could write a blog post or give a 45-minute talk and then like spark a discussion that maybe you've only ever programmed Ruby, but like when you hear, you know, about a spectrum and you know, Node falls over here and Elm falls over here and Elixir's community is like this and Ruby's community is like this and Ember's community is like this, it can contextualize that decision that you've made. And if you made one that doesn't suit where you land on that spectrum, you might realize like maybe I'm on the wrong bus. Mm-hmm. Without necessarily needing to read through a white paper of facts and figures to
right.
tell you that.
So where do you, what bus are you on?
Whew. I think that for the vast majority, I'll tell you a quick story. So as a consultant, we're brought in every now and then by an entrepreneur or a small business. You know, sometimes a startup is, you know, got the business pretty much figured out, but they're trying to, you know, build out their first or second iteration of their technical product. And Testable, my company, we mostly specialize on like big existing projects, teams that are already running for a while and they need some extra help. But we do talk to startups as well. And one thing that's really kind of concerned me over the last couple of years is that because Node and React is just like the default, and it's the most popular thing, and it's what, you know, especially newer programmers who are active in the startup community just sort of, you know, talk about the most. A lot of founders at companies or non-technical people are primed with the thinking that, like, you know, a node app of just a whole bunch of little tiny modules that are custom curated, you know, with a React front end, a Preact back end, microservices all over the place. Like, that is just the default correct way to write software. And I've had several, like, day-long inception meetings with founders where I'm like, you really don't need microservices. I had one come to me with, like, you know, a spreadsheet of hundreds of microservices that they designed on day one. I was like, I don't have to explain to you why that's probably not what you need on day one of your application. But culturally, that's kind of where we're at right now. And you ask me what bus I'm on. I'm on whatever bus needs the most help. And so, because that's my job, I'm always fixing. And so I wanna help the JavaScript community in general, but like the Node.js community in specific, to help smaller teams, especially, but actually, you know, all size teams deal with the just like gigantic complexity that you get from all this wheel reinvention, because there's a lot that we've learned in the Ruby and Rails community about convention over configuration, about good framework design, that we have to offer that. And so in terms of like low-hanging fruit, I have a lot more to help them than I do to the average Rails developer who's already seen the light.
It's interesting that you like, I always assumed that all developers hated legacy projects, right? And you're like, no, I embrace them. And it's
well, I wouldn't say I embrace them. You know, I discontent is basically my brand. So I wouldn't say I don't love them.
Welcome the challenge.
What I learned early on, I don't like speaking. I am not an extrovert. I am a pretty introverted person. But I learned long enough ago that good things happen when I push myself out of my comfort zone and become really comfortable with what makes me uncomfortable. Big gnarly code, yeah, it terrifies me. But if I put my mind to it and I try really hard, I'll come out the other end and I'll be able to make things better. And I'll learn a lot more from that big legacy mess than I'll learn from building the 50th little simple CRUD app from days 1 to 10, which are all the same across every single one of them.
Right.
Same reason I give talks. You know, like, I'm really afraid that I won't be able to do a good job on this or find a good story to tell. Mm-hmm. And so then I'll spend 200 hours on it and realize I'll learn a ton about myself in the process.
Right.
So that's, I think, where I really am. I'm curious what you guys think in terms of where you're headed or where your efforts would be best spent right now.
I mean, I maintain Rails because it's where I think I am able to benefit the most people per hour of time spent. And yeah, I do a lot of stuff in the Rust community, but I'll be doing that until I feel like I don't have anything meaningful to do there.
So I got into consulting like 4 years ago, mostly because I wanted to see more problems and I thought it was interesting and I really liked writing Rails. So I was like, cool, Rails consultancy checks both boxes. Let's do this. And now I feel like I've seen a lot of the problems to know that a lot of them are the same problem over and over again. And I'm not sure that Rails is the long term. Like, I do feel like there is going to be something that will enable us to write better software. And maybe it already exists. And I was saying earlier, somebody, we were talking about this, like, I also really like Elixir, right? And I've spent some time doing Elixir, but I don't feel like that's a radical departure from like what we already do in Rails. And I understand it's functional and all this stuff. And some people get really upset when I say it's still similar to Ruby and Rails. So I want to spend more time trying out the bus of like strong statically typed programming languages or something like that to see like, how does the solution change here? How does the process of developing the solution change? Like, what do I need for tests when I do something like that? What goes away? What are my new concerns? Because previous to this, all the things I've tried have been Ruby or Ruby adjacent type things that have different trade-offs, but of the same class, kind of that same kind of solution. So that's where I'd like to try and spend some time next. That said, like, ultimately, I'm going to do what the work is. And I have limited time to do outside of what the work is. So trying to find the work that's slightly different is kind of the challenge for me now.
Is there anything you want to plug before we wrap up?
Plug? Well, first of all, if you don't know me or follow me on the internets already, my last name is Searles, and my wife, who is a teacher, on the first day of class every year, will explain that it's spelled like the word pearls, like in the ocean, except with an S instead of a P. And if you've Googled for that hard, then you find me on Twitter. That's my Twitter handle, and find me on the line there. Test Double is the name of the agency, the company that I work with, and work software consultants just like Thoughtbot is. I'm not going to come here and say we're better than Thoughtbot, but you know that is now a direct quote. It's
entered into the record.
Yeah, just for the record and the transcript, feeding Google. love you, Chad. Other than that, you know, I'll just pick out something that I think is probably useful to this audience. If you're listening to a podcast, you probably are also on Twitter. You're probably also consuming a lot of different media all day. You probably, while you're programming, you command tab or alt tab a lot to other programs, and you switch contexts a lot. And research shows that context switching creates some mental residue that can last up to 20 minutes, further distracting us and preventing the real deep thought that leads to, you know, good work and good outcomes and better code and more productivity. There's a book by a guy named Cal, I forgot his last name, called Deep Work. And he's an academic who's a really, really prolific paper writer and author who specializes in kind of consuming that research and in a digestible way, both making the case to us that like living a more distraction-free lifestyle would result us in us being, you know, basically, there's an economic advantage to people who are able to focus for long periods of time. And two, gives you a lot of life hacks, ways to, you know, shut out a lot of the other stuff so that you have, you know, 4 to 6 hours of really, really focused time every day. And I'm working through that book right now, and it's been really great. But one of my favorite things is that he gives a case study of 3 different people that he thinks are awesome deep thinkers, deep workers. One is Nate Silver at 538. Mm-hmm. Forgot the other one because it's some investment banker dude bro. And then the third one blew my mind because he says this person is an amazing programmer of prolific skill who's just changed the world, and his name is David Heinemeier Hansen, who wrote this thing called Ruby on Rails. And he goes at length talking about the villa in Spain and the race cars, and clearly he's quite successful. And so I just like, it didn't really strike me as the David that I know that I've met. And so I asked David the other night, like, do you know that you're like a third of this very top selling book? And he had no idea, apparently. So I got a shout out for that book because it's Ruby on Rails endorsed.
Cool. Thanks for joining us, Justin.
Thank you. Always right. Fun.
Show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm/117. Thanks very much, and we'll see you next time.